It's showtime.
Go head on with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head on with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bycod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy. And here we go, off and running on this 13th day of September 2023. This is The Horn. HeadOn.live is where you'll find us on the interweb, too. That's where you go if you'd like to be part of the merry, wacky, zany, real-time, madcap, multimedia extravaganza that is The Horn chat room in the 3 hours in which this program is live, Monday through Friday, 5 to 8 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time, 2 to 5 p.m. Pacific Daylight Time, all time zones in between and the great globe around, and whatever time it is when you're listening to the podcast. And whether you're listening live via HeadOn.live or some other platform like, oh, TuneIn, and hit that heart button to tune in, or whether you're listening to the podcast, thank you for being a part of this remarkable little community over nearly 20 years. I'm getting ahead of myself. Nearly 20 years in the making. It really is something special. Thank you. If you're listening to the podcast, pretty please like it wherever you download it and subscribe to it and leave a comment for the algorithms. That's very helpful and helps to grow the program a little bit here and there, off and on, one step at a time. Okay. So, thanks for doing that. Hi, I'm Robin. It is, in fact, prayer meeting Wednesday on The Horn. And we've got some prayer meeting Wednesday stuff. But we've also got some other substantive, governmental, political-type stuff to go into this evening. Yeah. And every program here at The Horn begins with gratitude. And so, consequently, we say thanks to our 13th day of the month PayPal subscribers. And that merry band. Those happy few includes Paul. Thank you, Paul. And Gary and Gaia. Thank you both for keeping us from having a subscriberless day on the 13th of the month. Thank you. If you'd like to be a subscriber, it's ever so easy, especially if you're new to the program. Just go to PayPal. Or no, don't go to PayPal. Go to HeadOn.live. What am I talking about? Go to HeadOn.live. Put, say, $10 or, you know, $1.5 million. Either one. I'm kidding. But like if you do a $10 a month subscription here, and it's not required, we're giving everything away. No one has ever been charged a dime here. Everything's free. This is entirely voluntary. These are kind little gifts you provide to keep everything running here, so that this program can exist. If you put in $10, well, you'll be out. It's not half, and it's not a third. It's somewhere between a third and less than a half of a McDonald's hamburger, for God's sakes, per program over the course of a month. I mean, cheap. It's inexpensive. It's not even expensive. It's for free. But you're not going to be out very much. That's the bottom line. And so our fundraising goal presently stands at $1,440. So basically what that means is that we are $60 short of an entire broadcast week of funding. So that's today, Tuesday, Monday, Friday, and we're $60 into last Thursday before tomorrow. Yeah. And I'll just go ahead and say it. Tomorrow's one of those drop dead days. Power bill. And I got to do tags and new inspection sticker. The internet bill is not far away. Neither is the phone bill. But tomorrow is a drop dead day on the power bill, and those suckers want $400. Gets exhausting. That clean, cold electricity. But anyway, that's where it stands. And any help is great help. That said, before we dive into any of the religious insanity, a rather interesting story out of Politico of something that happened in the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals. A three-judge panel of the D.C. Circuit Court said that the Department of Justice's efforts to seize the cell phones of one of the January 6th conspirators is unconstitutional. And this is significant because, well, on a number of occasions here, many of you have posed the question, like on Friday on the front porch or just via email to me, that sort of thing. You've asked, damn it, why isn't Jack Smith going after those maggot congressmen who worked hand in glove with Donald J. Trump to try to overturn the election of 2020 and, by extension, overturn the Constitution of the United States itself? Why aren't they going after them? Well, we have an answer of sorts. Even before Jack Smith, and this goes to something we have talked about in the past, the investigation has been going since before Jack Smith. It's been going virtually since the immediate aftermath of the domestic terror attack on the Capitol of the United States of January 6, 2021. And one of the things that the DOJ did was to subpoena and have to get a search warrant for and have a United States District Court sign off on it as permissible. The cell phone of one of the lead maggots in the Congress of the United States, namely the head of the Feedum carcass, Scott Perry of Pennsylvania, the Commonwealth thereof. Now, today, a three-judge panel of the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals said, no, DOJ, you can't just have his cell phone in its entirety. And held, in fact, that a Congress critter's cell phone or cell phones, one never knows how many burner phones a maggot congressman has, they're covered, the communications on that cell phone are covered by the speech and debate clause. As is often the case with constitutional issues, this gets rather sticky and complicated rather quickly. The speech and debate clause was put in as a bulwark against a bully, primarily executive branch, who wanted to punish members of the House or Senate for speaking out in the course and scope of their constitutionally oath-sworn duties of representation. And so this three-judge panel, interestingly, comprised of two maggots and a Pappy Bush appointee. The opinion was written by Naomi Rao, and oh my God, what a piece of work she is. Joined by another maggot by the name of Greg Katsas and Karen LaCraft Henderson, literally a Karen, who was placed on the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals by virtue of a nomination, an appointment from George H.W. Bush. And Naomi Rao, and good God, she's awful. Just look her up. I have neither the time nor the stomach to note just with particularity how god awful she is. She said that while elections are political events, a member's deliberation, and if anybody's a member, Scott Perry is a member. A member's deliberation about whether to certify a presidential election or how to assess information regarding relevant to legislation about federal election procedures are textbook legislative acts. Are they really? Is that what the DOJ was looking for? No, the DOJ and the FBI were looking for evidence of a criminal conspiracy to overturn the government of the United States of America. But according to this maggot circuit judge, it's just deliberation about whether to certify a presidential election or how to assess information. In answer to Ralph's question right away, can this be appealed to the full circuit? Yes, it can. And in point of fact, under the rules of the court as it the circuit court as it operates, if Jack Smith chooses to appeal this maggot ruling to the en banc panel of the D.C. Circuit, it will put Naomi Rao and the other maggots and Karen's ruling on hold. In point of fact, when asked for comment, the special prosecutor's office said no comment. Now, the maggot Greg Katsas did, however, file a concurring opinion separately in which he said that the speech and debate clause privilege for members of Congress is narrower than the Karen or Naomi Rao, the maggot maxima, had held. It's a distinction without a difference in this case. It was back in August 22 that the FBI seized the maggot conspirator Scott Perry's cell phone. But they didn't immediately delve into the phone, and they sought a second search warrant regarding whether it could review Scott Perry's communications with other members of members of Congress, see also, compare favorably, co-conspirators. Or the executive branch, see also, id, co-conspirators. The ruling wasn't as broad as perhaps Scott Perry and the other maggot co-conspirators might have liked. By the way, the trial judge in this case is a rock-solid trial court judge, Beryl Howell. And she had said that Scott Perry's informal fact-finding about the 2020 election was not in fact, and she's right, not in fact covered by the speech and debate clause. and was not protected against review by the DOJ. But Naomi Rao, Maggot Maxima, said, along with the Karen and the other maggot, said, nah, a member of Congress doesn't have to be acting in an official capacity, like on behalf of a committee, in order for their conspiratorial machinations to be protected by the speech and debate clause. The maggot wrote, "We disagree with the district court's holding that informal fact-finding is never a legislative act, but we also reject Representative Perry's proposition that informal fact-finding is always a legislative act. What we are finding here is that we hope to protect a vicious conspirator against the Constitution of the United, States, you understand." And so they the three-judge panel bounced it back to Judge Howell to re-decide the case in line with their maggoty thinking. Rao went on and said, "Representative Perry's conversations with other members concerned the passage of proposed legislation as well as the exercise of the constitutional duty to certify the electoral votes in the 2020 election." That proposed legislation? That would be that phony baloney electors scam, I suspect. And it was not about the exercise of his constitutional duty to certify the electoral votes. It was about his desire not to. To further an ongoing criminal conspiracy with other maggots inside the legislative branch as well as inside the executive branch. "These communications were privileged, and we leave it to the district court to implement this holding on a communication-by-communication basis." In other words, if this ruling were to stand, Beryl Howell could still go through each and every message and say, yes, no, yes, no. And there's an almost impossible standard for her to adhere to because it creates this dichotomy between integral and essential communication relative to being a member of Congress versus whatever isn't. Which is rather of a hot mess. Interesting, though, because, as ever, politics makes strange bedfellows. It wasn't just J6 conspirator Scott Perry who objected to all of this. No, it wasn't. It was a joint intervention by both Republicans and Democrats against the DOJ's efforts to take a look at the or go in search of evidence of the conspiracy. And it's a fairly it's been a while since the court took a look at the speech and debate clause. And this three-judge right-wing panel even went so far as to say that Scott Perry was being a bit overbroad. "To the extent Representative Perry also suggests the privilege extends to any and all factual conversations a member has with individuals outside Congress. Our case law offers no support for that assertion. Which is something we've talked about on this program well prior to this ruling. When you go out and blather to Fox News TV, Radio Rwanda, or Newsmuck, or that guy who looks like rancid hot dog water smells, it is unreasonable to think that the speech and debate clause covers that. And arguably so, too, does conspiring with the executive branch. And they went so far as to say, well, yeah, Jack Smith, you can take a look at Scott Perry's stuff on his phone, like newsletters or talking points memos or I wonder if the speech and debate clause covers communications with, say, not saying that they're there, but just in case. Well, I don't know, Stuart, you'll shoot your eye out, kid Rhodes, or Enrique Tarrio, or Joe Biggs, or Alex Jones. Or how about Laura Frau Ingram? Or testicle-toasting Tokyo Rose Carlson? Jack Smith is a sharp lawyer. If he decides to challenge this and ask for an en banc hearing, he may get a different ruling entirely, perhaps more in his favor. And then, of course, off to our most puissant, dread sovereign, supreme Catholic majesties, it goes. Yeah, I said, or Stuart, you'll shoot your eye out, kid Rhodes, or Enrique Tarrio, Ralph's was right there, or Ginsurrectionist Thomas. Yeah, she seemed to be having a lot of email and text conversations with, I mean, there she was, blathering away with Mark Meadows. Who may, it seems, be going to trial in Fulton County and not getting his stuff severed. In which case, one wonders just how many people he will wind up implicating. Oh, and thank you, Ralphs. In an effort to knock down the $1,440 fundraising goal by 50, taking us down to $1,390. Thank you, Ralphs. The challenge for the cat bear story that Ralphs sent along. Maribel? Shh, Maribel, did you hear that? I did. Why is Mom using the R word? Any idea? Mom never puts household garbage into the outside can until the morning pickup. All that goes into the can, double bagged as dirty cat litter. Yeah, Mom's very bear aware. Mr. Bear tipped the can, Mom heard it, and raced to the porch in time to see him run off with the garbage bag full of litter. She yelled at him and said, "No!" But he didn't listen, just raced off carrying his treasure. Mr. Bear thought he'd found an easy meal, so that's why the R word. Yeah, but Mom feels bad for him. She feels like she let him down. Is that what Mom was searching for, the disappointing bag? Yep. Maybe he thought it was almond roca. Crunchy on the outside, soft in the middle. Ralphs, dinner in the Eastern Daylight Time Zone for the live audience is, well, that one's your fault. But anyway, if somebody would like to jump in and match $25, it'll get us down to $13.90, and that would be a huge help. And I'd really like to have electricity about this time tomorrow, so that we can do Thorn in the Side Thursday. And again, that's $400 that they're rather stern about. And going back to the speech and debate clause, Steve in New York says, don't think this didn't cross my mind, too. The speech and debate clause covers cell phones? I'm pretty sure the original intent of the speech and debate clause didn't include cell phone discussions. Well, it's not very originalist of Naomi Rao, now, is it? But then again, they... originalism is just a judicial fraud. It's a means to an end. It's cynical Machiavellianism. I mean, all you got to do is look at DC versus Heller. And the original meaning of keep and bear was... And this is not like the bear with the kitty poo. Keeping bear was assumed to mean own, which in the 18th century bore almost no relationship to each other. So there we are. Meanwhile, since I mentioned Fulton County, let's wander down there on this prayer meeting Wednesday. The DA there, Fonnie Willis, badass woman who is not afraid to lecture a moron who got his law degree by tracing a turtle onto a piece of paper and mailing it off, namely Jim Jacketoff Jordan, who, she reminded us, is not a member of any bar, having a got a trial date for Kenneth Cheesebro, the guy who looks like Mr. Rogers with a Xanax problem, and Squidney the Kraken lawyer Powell. Well, those two geniuses are going to trial. Let's see, 13, let's see, 7, 17, 20, 20. Those two geniuses are going to trial in 30 days. Because they wanted speedy trials. Well, Fonnie Willis has made another filing in the case. And she said, as regard to the other recalcitrant defendants who are not in any hurry.
I'm definitely not in any hurry to try this case. I'm tired of getting beaten around by black women.
In her memo, Fonnie Willis's office said, no court has forbade holding all the trials together, and it would be much more logistically simple to try them all at once rather than in multiple tranches of trials that might be running at the same time with different judges and different juries. And that each and every case will require the same evidence, the same witnesses, the same sets of proof. The memo appeared on the court docket today. The state maintains that all the defendants shall be tried together. The RICO conspiracy charge ensures any trial would share the same evidence and witnesses. And that's 150 witnesses over the course of some 4 months. Then that's without even taking into account jury selection. Because that's, I guess, 19 lawyers plus the prosecution engaging in voir dire. And now, Fonnie Willis did say, listen, after we start the trial of Mr. Rogers on Xanax and Squidney, well, then the other defendants could go, yeah, we want a speedy trial too. In which case, there would be an absolute logistic and scheduling nightmare. And she went on to say, listen, it's not like the Fulton County Superior Court can't handle a big case. In fact, she said, the state is capable of trying large and complex cases, and pointed to a 35-defendant RICO case that wound up trying 13 defendants, but went so far as to say it would create an enormous strain to do a bunch of different identical trials at the same time. But, of course, the pettifoggers representing Nitwit Nero, oh, we couldn't possibly be ready by October the 23rd. We have no idea what the state's talking about. We've never heard of any of this, even though they generated all of the evidence against them. And Stephen Sadow, but, oh, no, we don't want a speedy trial. The last thing in the world we want. We want the slowest trial possible. We want a trial with all deliberate slowness. And sooner or later, is it, yeah, no, Lee, not a member of any bar, not even Cheers, where everybody knows your name. Well, everybody knows Jim Jacket Off Jordan's name. It's not that a lot of people want to, though. But since this case is basically coming first on October 23rd, there's a bit of a domino theory in effect. Insofar as if they can screw up the scheduling on this one, then they can say, well, we can't possibly go to trial in January 4th in D.C., and we can't possibly go to trial in March in Miami, and, you know, basically...
I can't go to trial any time before the sun burns out, or I die. I'm rooting for the sun to burn out. Because after the sun burns out, it'll burn up all my money, and I won't care about being alive.
You know, stoke the stroke. And I guess, by the way, news out of the land behind the Zion curtain today. Mitt Romney says he's not going to run for another term in the Senate. I guess it's just not fun. Or that he has seen the handwriting on the wall, many take Lou Farson. And having seen the moving hand write and move on, nah,
I don't want to be senator anymore. I'm not going to run again. I think I'm just going to sit back and open up and look at my binder full of women.
But there is a book coming out by McKay Coppins about Bishop Willard Romney and his time in the Senate. You might recall that photograph of Bishop Willard having dinner with Nitwit Nero and looking back over his shoulder at the photographer as if to, you know, blink once for yes, Willard. Blink twice for no. Are you safe? Blink, blink. But according to McKay Coppins, perhaps Romney's most surprising discovery upon entering the Senate was that his disgust with Trump was not unique among his Republican colleagues. Almost without exception, he told me, they shared my view of the president. In public, of course, they played their parts as Trump loyalists, often contorting themselves rhetorically to defend the president's most indefensible behavior. But in private, they ridiculed his ignorance, rolled their eyes at his antics, and made incisive observations about his warped, toddler-like psyche. Romney went on to say that one senior Republican senator said,
"He has none of the qualities you would want in a president, and all of the qualities you wouldn't."
Now, I don't know that that was Moscow Mitch McConnell, but a sentence like that sounds good in the turtle voice, doesn't it? Romney went on to tell a story. Maybe this is why he decided not to run, because he decided to spill the beans. This excerpt comes from The Atlantic, by the way. One afternoon in March 2019, Trump paid a visit to the Senate Republicans' weekly caucus lunch. He was in a buoyant mood. 2 days earlier, the Justice Department had announced the much-anticipated report from Special Counsel Robert Mueller failed to establish collusion between the Trump campaign and Russia during the 2016 election. It did no such thing. It merely said that based upon DOJ guidance, Office of Legal Counsel guidance, the president could not be charged, so why bother? And then, of course, Bill barred a prosecution, who later, maybe being charitable, figured out that maybe he'd been had, ran out and torpedoed the report before anybody could actually read it. Anyway, as Romney later wrote in his journal, the president was met with a standing ovation fit for a conquering hero and then launched into some rambling remarks. He talked about the so-called Russia hoax and relitigated the recent midterm elections and swung wildly from one tangent to another. He declared somewhat implausibly that the GOP would soon become the party of health care and that the senators were respectful and attentive. But as soon as he left the room, according to Romney's diary entry, the entire Republican caucus burst into paroxysms of laughter. Of course, today, when he said he wasn't going to run again, Julius Geezer went immediately to his speciously valued and perhaps collapsing rattle-trap social media platform, Tripe Social, and with all caps,
"Fantastic news for America, the great state of Utah, and for the Republican Party. Mitt Romney, sometimes referred to as Pierre Delecto, will not be seeking a second term in the U.S. Senate, where he did not serve with distinction."
Pierre Delecto. Pierre, because it's French, because he, at a time when his country might have needed him, I guess, he was busy in Paris defending Paris from the Viet Cong, riding throughout the arrondissement and yelling, "The VC are coming! They're coming, my friends!" on his bicycle. But apparently there are some juicy tidbits in this book. On January the 2nd, 2021, Bishop Senator Willard sent a text message to Moscow Mitch Moscow Mitch never replied. By the way, McKay Coppin's book, this is in it as well. It's called Romney, A Reckoning. And the timeline on this starts with independent Maine Senator Angus King sending a text to Willard saying, could you give me a call when you get a chance? Important. And so Bishop Willard picks up a call, picks up a phone and calls, calls Angus. And Angus says, listen, I just had a conversation with somebody pretty high up at the Pentagon. You need to hear this. Law enforcement has been tracking online chatter among right-wing extremists who appear to be planning something bad on the day of Donald Trump's upcoming rally in Washington, D.C. The president's been telling them the election was stolen, and now they're coming to steal it back. There's talk of gun smuggling, of bombs and arson, of targeting the traitors in Congress who are responsible for this travesty. Romney's name has been popping up in some frightening corners of the internet, which is why King needed to talk to him. He isn't sure Romney will be safe. Well, that certainly got Bishop Willard's attention. You might recall that in the video there, wasn't there that we saw that was released by the J6 committee during their investigation of Bishop Willard coming perilously close to actually being in contact with the terrorist maggots, remember? Well, Bishop Willard, while he did not, and maybe could not, warn the nation, tried to warn Moscow Mitch. This is the text. In case you've not heard this, I just got a call from Angus King, who said that he had spoken with a senior official at the Pentagon, who reports that they're seeing very disturbing social media traffic regarding the protest planned for the 6th. There are calls to burn down your home, Mitch, to smuggle guns into D.C., and to storm the Capitol. I hope that sufficient security plans are in place. They weren't. But I'm concerned that the instigator, the president, is the one who commands the reinforcements the D.C. and Capitol Police might require. And I want to be a little charitable here. Because for all of his faults, and lo, they are legion, Bishop Willard Romney had actually had governmental executive experience running the Commonwealth of Massachusetts as a Republican. And the people of that blue state said, yeah, okay, let's let him. You remember how he was plastered with the term Romney Care when the Affordable Care Act was first proposed? And well, some of us, and I was one of them, said, Jesus Christ, we finally get some sort of a health care reform bill, and it's just a blueprint of a Heritage Foundation thing. But he did his due diligence. I mean, granted, he couldn't get on his bicycle and go do the Paul Revere thing, through the halls of Congress. The maggots are coming, the maggots are coming, the maggots are coming. But as of January 2nd, they knew that, and I kind of hate the word chatter, don't you? There were threats. The word we're looking for here is threats. To literally burn down the home of Moscow Mitch McConnell, presumably with Moscow Mitch and his wife, Elaine, in it. There are calls to burn down your home, Mitch. And you can almost hear the gravity when you burn down your home, comma, Mitch. That's a direct address. I'm not fucking around here. And to storm the Capitol. And tellingly, to smuggle guns into D.C. And frankly, this text message raises more questions than it answers. It answers, frankly, very few. And by the way, McConnell never responded. He did not respond with a phone call to Bishop Willard. He didn't respond by text. He didn't respond by email. He didn't walk up and say,
"Well, I think you need to stop being such a histrionic little sissy, Mitch. These are our people. They're going to be coming from my state. They're probably going to be coming from your state. They're good Republicans. Willard?"
No, no response at all. Bill Collins, no reply at all. But the J6 committee made clear that, yes, there were guns smuggled. And that when Nitwit Nero was told about the smuggled guns, he said,
"I'm not worried. Why are we worried? Those are our people. Take down the magnetometers. Let them have their guns."
Because he wanted them to go and murder people in the Capitol. Because he, as the dear leader, the maximum president for life, the mother of all POTUSes, felt like shedding the blood of members of the Congress was a worthy sacrifice in his name. And so bring their guns they did. Remember how we talked about the way that law enforcement got on their communications devices and said, "Yeah, we got one up a tree here. Looks like he's got a AR-15 with a sniper scope on it."
Yeah, those are our people. What are we worried about?
And what about these Pentagon officials? Is it fair to ask the question? Sorry, computer glitch there. Is it fair to ask the question, what would have happened if what was coming on January the 6th had been more broadly publicized? What Romney said, namely that Nitwit Nero was in charge of augmenting security, was A, true, and B, a prediction for future chaos. Where were these Pentagon? Where was this brass? And why were the American people not told? And one wonders if we will ever know the answer. And I frankly don't know. So there's that. I wonder if the multimillionaire for-profit media will ask Mitch, "Senator, Why didn't you respond to a warning stating that Trump's followers want to burn down your house and smuggle guns into D.C. and attack the Capitol? Why didn't you respond to that? Well, there's never been a better time for Mitch to glitch. Has there? No. Steve says, the text message, something tells me it went something like this to Mitch. Hey, Mitch, I just got some interesting information from the Pentagon about some disturbing chatter about violence on January 6th. Nothing from Mitch. Mitch, the information concerns you personally. Nothing from Mitch. Mitch, they're going to burn down your house. Actually, I read the entire text there, Steve. That was the text. That was not some sort of prose paraphrase of the text. That was the text.
Well, you see, as we know now, that originated with Angus King, and he's an independent, but he votes with the Democrats. So I looked at it as probably being an attempt to subvert the Republican caucus by the Democrat Party.
Tell me that's impossible. Tell me that is not right in the wheelhouse of Moscow Mitch McConnell. A speech in the cell phone clause. David the Blind says, as we all know, the Constitution didn't exist before Jim Schultz Jordan was born. The conservative bowel movement was there fertilizing the ground so the Constitution could be misrepresented in the modern age. Glory be to the founding fathers and to the Trumps and to the bigoted idiots. And Lindsey Graham and Mike Pence said, amen. And that's A-H-M-E-N. Your buddy Dave in the Blind. Yes. Amen. Probably does it just like that. And a little bit of an update. Susanna Gibson's revenge porn crime, or the crime revenge porn crime perpetrated against her, Theo has been keeping up with this and says that it's beginning to get a little bit of play in the for-profit media with some better focus than Laura Vozella and the Washington Post. Gave it, you know, remember that headline was Virginia Dem House Candidate Performs Sex Online with Husband for Tips, when it should have read Virginia Dem House Candidate Victim of Revenge Porn Sex Crime. But that's on the copy editor, right? But, of course, the multimillionaire for-profit media is still out there. Well, they cannot resist talking about a woman having consensual sex with her husband. Oh, well. No. Just not gonna. Oh, and I should have mentioned this yesterday. This was news. Good news. The federal grand jury has gone after the five dirty homicidal cops who slaughtered Tyree Nichols. They beat him to death back last January. January the 7th, during a traffic stop of extremely, well, contrived notions. Four-count indictment, federal grand jury. The grand jury said they obscured body camera recordings. They lied to their superiors. They just didn't know about the camera up on the light pole. The two civil rights felonies with which they are charged carry a maximum punishment of life in prison upon conviction. The other two counts get you up to 20, get them up to 20 years in the joint. They probably won't plead guilty. So there will very likely be a trial. To Darius Bean, Demetrius Haley, Emmett Martin, Desmond Mills Jr. And all because they were, these cops were tasked with being, you know, their job was to be badass cops. Among his last words, Tyree Nichols, were, "I didn't do anything. Just trying to go home." Justin Smith was the fifth one. They're all black. They dummied up a story that Tyree Nichols was so strong that he lifted two officers into the air. Meanwhile, the lawyer for the dirty cops one of them, Michael Stengel, who represents Haley, said,
"The indictment is disappointing, but not surprising."
Another pettifogger, William Massey, said,
"Oh, we've been expecting it and are ready to move forward."
And see, unlike representing Trump, their bills will be paid. By the cop union, probably. Another pettifogger, Blake Ballin,
It does not change Mr. Mills' position. He will continue to defend himself against all allegations in both the state and federal court systems.
And these are separate from the state court charges of murder. So, we will watch and wait and hope for justice for Tyree Nichols. And punishment to the maximum extent of the law. For the defendants. We are at the top of the hour. And I'm pleased to note that I arranged for a conversation last week with a dear friend of mine. Her name is Alessandria. She's a former volunteer coordinator and board member of multiple organizations based in Mobile, Alabama. She now lives in her new city of Los Angeles because she had to flee her home 40 years due to anti-trans legislation there in Alabama. Political activity. She works from home in the tech industry. That's what allowed her to escape safely to L.A. And she's now working at rebuilding her life while continuing to make progress in the fifth year of her transition. I first met Allie a little over 2 years ago, August of 2021, down on the beach in Gulf Shores, at a time when the state of Alabama had only begun to go crazier than a sprayed roach, and now has gone fully crazy. And so I reached out to Allie because she said some things in the past about the last gasp of fascism, and I wanted to go into that and a number of other things with her, and she kindly said, sure. So, Allie, hey.
Hey, Robin. Thanks for having me on. It's great to talk to you again.
Oh, it's wonderful to talk to you. How are you?
Oh, I'm doing great. Still settling in, but, you know, life's pretty good, all things considered.
How long have you been out there now?
It's been about 4 months. We came down here in April.
4 months, a near
hurricane. We're in month five now.
Yeah, 4 months, a near hurricane, and an earthquake or two.
At the same time.
Yes. You know, hurricane girl brought the hurricanes with her from the Gulf. I know, you felt terrible.
They're following me around, I suppose.
Yeah, well, you know, it's hard to avoid greatness when it's in you, or hurricanes when it's in you, and it's in the situation. I wanted to tell you right off the bat, without mentioning your name, I have talked about you in the past on this program, in an effort to get people to understand the degree of trauma and stress that people like us are under. In blood red states that have decided that we are the people they are going to ride to their, I guess, political glory on. So you are not, or at least your story is not unfamiliar to the Horn Family Community Congregation. But I wanted, like I said, in introducing you, to delve into some of the ideas that you have put forward regarding where we stand now, as horrifying as things are, and where we are going, because they don't just touch on issues related to the LGBTQ IA plus community, but to the country at large. And you've said that you think 2024 is their last gasp. Could you please expand upon that?
Sure. So it's basically a demographic situation here, where 2024, in terms of nationwide electoral politics, at least, is the last chance that the more fascist leaning element of the electorate has in order to use the electoral system to achieve enough power to then cement that power. After 2024, the next presidential election in 2028, Gen Z will be 30 years old. The population of the country will be less religious, less white, more LGBTQ plus accepting, more socially left, more economically left. In the past, this has been the normal path of things, especially on the social side of things. A few steps back here and there, like, you know, 1980. But for the most part, the parties have both slowly moved to the left on social issues. We don't have to go back very far to find the Democratic Party not being in support of LGBTQ issues whatsoever, for example. But as generations come in with new civil rights fights, they slowly pull parties to the left. It creates this illusion that people get more conservative as they get older, when in reality they stand still and the parties move left, and so they switch their party. A small number of people, maybe 10-20%, will move over that way. So demographically speaking, the Republican Party is going to have to move to the left in order to have any chance of winning political power in the United States through elections. After that, it's going to be, you know, impossible to get enough states, get enough senators, enough representatives in order to be able to advance their agenda at a national level.
Okay.
What we've seen in the past about 6 years has been a rightward shift to the Republican Party. So they're actually exacerbating this trend, and it's happening sooner than it otherwise would have, which is why you see such a record amount of voting from Gen Z, even already, in terms of how they're aligning with the two parties. There's always been, you know, the preference of the younger generation to switch to the more, to go with the more left-leaning party in elections. But the difference in, that we're seeing today versus the past is extreme. And it's because of that recent rightward shift from the Republicans. And they're not going to be able to maintain that for much longer.
And that all makes very hopeful sense to me. What about, I mean, and obviously you're in a state now where there is no, there's no risk of you being overtaken by some sort of red wave. I mean, I think California is safe for the near future, and maybe hope, right? But everything that you've just said is predicated upon a federal analysis, a nationwide analysis. What happens in places? Right. What happens in places like the state you just fled, or the state where I live? Does it? Do they just keep doubling down?
They will try, and whether or not they're able to succeed is going to depend on what the federal court system is willing to tolerate. Unfortunately, so with federal control. A party that is in favor of trans rights, for example, could pass legislation in accordance with that, but then a Supreme Court could strike that down. A state could assert that they have the ability to, you know, restrict certain civil liberties, and the Supreme Court could decide that they do or that they don't. So that's going to be a fight, and it's one we've had before in this country. You can see it in the civil rights era. I could see it, you know, and we kind of fought a war over that. So it's been part of our struggle as a nation all along. That will continue, and it's also going to continue to change demographics. We've already had estimates put about 250,000 transgender people leaving the state that they live in and going to a state where their rights are more protected. That comes out to about 8% or so of the total trans population in the country. And another roughly 40% of that population have stated that they are considering it. If things continue to move where you've got very safe states, legally speaking, and very restricted states, like as bad as Florida, where even adults are being detransitioned now by the state, then you're going to see that number go from, you know, 8 to much closer to 50%, and it's going to be a substantial demographic shift that will change a lot of other electoral things, too. So we do have to keep an eye on that.
And you know, as I mean, you know, I'm in West Virginia, and we're not. Well, maybe it becomes a distinction without a difference. We're not as batshit crazy as, say, Alabama or Florida, but there's more than enough people in the state government in West Virginia who would like to be like Florida and Alabama and Tennessee, for that matter. What did you before you left? Did you research where you wanted to go? You know, as we noted in your introduction, you're able to work from home, so that was a big factor in your ability to move. But did you? I guess I could just say, why California? You know, why not Washington? Why not Oregon? Why not Illinois, Minnesota, Michigan, et cetera? Was there any factor in particular?
There were a number of factors. So we looked at a lot of places. Erin Reed, if you're familiar with her work, has a map of the states of the U.S. and has, you know, those that are offering specific trans protections and those that are putting in specific restrictions on trans rights. And they're at different levels of severity, as well as different levels of risk, looking ahead over the next year or two of legislation coming down the pipe in those states. So we pretty much restricted our search to only the safe states as a hard limit. And then from there, we looked at, you know, the pros and cons of living in different cities within those states. We did want to live in a city because it wasn't enough to just have the legal protections that you get from the state laws. We also needed the cultural protections of a city to prevent, you know, suffering from violence, which is just as likely in the countryside of a blue state as it is in a red state.
Well, that's true, because that was one of the next things I was going to go into with you, was the fact that while we tend to look at things in a binary sense of red and blue, the fact of the matter is California has had no small number of upheavals, if I understand correctly. Do I?
That's absolutely correct. There's even in Los Angeles, there have been, just since I've moved here, two specific anti-trans demonstrations, one that occurred outside of an elementary school that included fascists shouting slurs at school children, and then another in downtown of the city that was had Proud Boys serving as security forces. There are fascist movements, especially centered in Glendale in Los Angeles right now, posting all sorts of things on posts, you know, posters of people, a non-binary journalist in particular, they have targeted with all sorts of you know, sneers and false allegations to try to incite violence against that individual and other individuals associated with school boards and so forth. So the fight is happening everywhere. There is no sanctuary in the United States where you are completely safe from it. And there won't be until this fight is won, and we are some distance from that. But there is relative sanctuary. You know, I went from being worried if my marriage was going to be annulled based on how they considered my trans status upon, you know, revisiting marriage equality and whether I would be forcibly detransitioned by the state, have my medication outlawed, that sort of thing. And, you know, being an activist, I was far too visible to go underground where I was living. I had been interviewed on the news already. My face was out there. So it was a very real, like, I could be facing the threat of incarceration within the next couple years and or making decisions I couldn't live with if I stay. So those concerns are gone, but that doesn't mean that, you know, there aren't other concerns still here.
Can you talk a little bit, Allie, about the emotional toll that took?
Oh gosh.
I mean, I don't want to trigger or anything like that, but I think it's beneficial for people to know.
I agree. It's important to talk about, and I'm comfortable sharing. It was just in the last week that I was, you know, in tears again, even 5 months later, for the community that I left behind. This was, with everybody I knew. You know, I spent the first part of my life, the first 36 years of it, most of it, apart from like early childhood, pretty isolated. I never had more than a few friends at a time, very close friends, very dear friends. But that was my entire social life. It was, you know, a couple friends, and if they were busy one weekend, I didn't have a social life that weekend. And I spent a lot of time online in my house on the computer. When I came out, I actually found a community for the first time in my life. I found people that I belonged with, people who were like me, people who understood what it was like, people who we supported each other. You know, I got so much advice on how to go through all of this process, what to avoid, what to do, where to go, where not to go, and more events and social gatherings than I actually had time to attend, which was a brand new problem for me as somebody who was so isolated for so long. And 5 months ago, I left all of that behind and went to a whole new city. I do have family here. I had some online acquaintances that, you know, starting to turn into friendships. I've got, you know, one friend here in particular that I've met. I don't have that community network that I had. And of course, it wasn't just the community I belonged to. It was just a couple years of joining that community, and I was in an organizing position. So I was taking responsibility for a lot of those events. I was helping to put them on and to get word out. I was running a support group for trans people.
I'm sitting here with a little bit of a smile. I'm sitting here with a little bit of a smile on my face, Allie, because the only reason I showed up down at the beach is because you organized that. And that was, I mean, it wasn't the Normandy invasion or anything, but it took a lot of effort, and it remains one of the most special weekends, you know, hurricane notwithstanding, of my recent life and my transition. And you and I had a chance to talk a little bit here and there during those couple of days, and we found out that I should backtrack and say this is Prayer Meeting Wednesday. We do this every Wednesday, and we feature the obscenities and ridiculousness and viciousness of what I've been calling for 20 years the religion industry. You and I have a common background relative to the fact that we were both, I guess you could say, dipped by the heel. And it's not exactly uncommon to people raised in Alabama, but we were dipped by the heel in basically evangelical fundamentalist Christianity. And there's
right.
And I refer to myself to this day as a recovering Southern Baptist. You know, just like other people recover from other things. The only thing is we don't get a 12-step program. We just try to get better a little bit every day. Can you talk a little bit about what that did relative to your emergence and what kind of a hurdle that was to get over?
Oh, it delayed it so much. So I was a practicing Southern Baptist for a long time, to the point of I went to a Southern Baptist school, so I had it, you know, 6 days a week. It lasted through my late teen years, and then I was like non-denominational for another probably decade after that. So in my upbringing, it wasn't just that being queer was bad, right? Like, you know, being gay is a sin or whatever. It was that it was not a valid existence, period. There was no such thing as being trans, right? It was just people who were mentally ill or enveloped in sin. So it wasn't something you could identify as. So every experience that I had from being 4 years old to 14, it was all bent through that lens. Things were just either sinful temptations, or I was just misunderstanding what it was, having to redirect it to some other explanation, you know, living in denial and repression. Very common story for queer people that were raised evangelical of, you know, all letters. So for me, I was 30 years old before I acknowledged it, what was going on with me, before I accepted that I was something other than a cisgender man. By that point, I had, you know, developed all sorts of coping mechanisms, which were mostly escapism related and avoidance. So that was where a lot of that isolation came from. Even after accepting that, it was a 5-year process of exploration, stuff I should have done when I was a child. You know, the things that you do when you're a teenager, usually to figure out who you are, I did them when I was 30. And 5 years later, after, you know, struggling with it, to the point where my suicidal ideation had approached like making concrete plans, and I knew I wasn't going to live to see 40, that I finally took the plunge and went and got a specialized therapist and started the process.
It's amazing the commonalities that we can find within these experiences. You talk about, you know, from 4 years on, you learn early on not to express anything but brutal masculinity, and that gets reinforced so easily and so thoroughly. I can remember we had I think it was called Melmac. It's kind of a plastic that was our everyday dinnerware, and there was green ones and blue ones, and orange ones and pink ones. And I so thoroughly was so pre-repressed for their convenience. My mother quickly learned, no, Robin will not eat off the pink plate, because I was so terrified I remember that my mother was a dancer in high school and wanting to teach me to dance. No, Mom, no, because it might, because if so much as a fleck of shell falls out of the egg, the whole damn thing collapses. And that, and
right.
that way lay doom.
Absolutely. It's this fear, and you're not even sure what you're afraid of, but you know you have to stay really far away from whatever that is.
Yeah.
Yeah, our experiences rhyme. You know, we don't have the same stories, but everybody's story has these common threads that manifest in different ways for their personality and circumstances.
It's amazing to meet a total stranger and then, oh, yeah. And you, and I hope I'm not delving too deeply, but you even went so far as going down a right-wing rat hole at one point, right?
Absolutely, yeah. So that evangelical upbringing was total. I was fervently religious, but that also translated into, in the early days, being a typical social conservative. I grew up during the Reagan years in a very Reagan household. At least, in my earliest years, but that persisted. I started to have a rebellious phase, like toward high school, pulling away from all of that, and was moving away from that, especially socially. And then 9/11 hit, and as with many millennials, that swung things back to the right for me. And I probably spent the next close to a decade as a libertarian, and like a pretty, pretty serious one. Like I was pretty far to the bottom right of the 2D political compass in terms of ideology. It's a pretty shameful period of my life.
No, I don't think shame need be a part of it. It's kind of to be expected. You're certainly A, not the only one, and B, It was an on-ramp you were put onto. I've made arguments over the years talking about, for instance, because of the nature, this is media work that I do. And all the years that I went up and down the road, especially when I was a practicing and traveling lawyer, the only thing on AM radio was Rush Limbaugh. And if the only information you have is that, and I remember asking myself, where's the other side? Because way back then, I was a huge fan of a guy named, and he's a dear friend of mine, Mike Malloy. And I could sit and hold my radio just right out in the garage and tune in WLS Chicago at 10 o'clock Eastern and hear him. And he refuted everything. But by God, it was not to be had. There was no response, and when you seed the ground, this is the point. When you seed the ground, when one side seeds the field of battle completely to the other, what are people going to do but gravitate to the only voice out there? So it's no surprise that you wound up there, and that ever so many people, I was born basically due north of you, as far north in Alabama as you can go and not be in Tennessee, and it was largely the same thing. The Baptist church and the dinners on the ground and prayer meeting Wednesday and dinner in the fellowship hall and the deacons making corny jokes and you're right. Now there is an age difference for the two of us, so I was getting out of high school as Ronald Reagan was coming in. But it was the damnedest thing. Ronald Reagan announced his, or came to Tuscumbia, Alabama, the little town with scum in the middle, and made a campaign stump speech in one of the headquarter homes of the Klan. And I think it was over a Labor Day, and I think it was over a Labor Day weekend, and I actually found and shared on air a couple of years ago, I found the newspaper clipping from the Florence Times Tricycle Daily talking about his appearance and completely blowing past all of the ugliness that was inherent in his campaign And from that moment forward till the moment that he declared states' rights at the Neshoba County, Mississippi Fairgrounds in August of 1980, it was his first speech after he received the Republican nomination, and everybody knew. And lo and behold, that's when you get,
well, I didn't leave the Democrat Party. The Democrat Party left me.
And it became a rallying cry, and suddenly the prophecy of LBJ in 1965, we have lost the South for a generation, I don't think he understood quite the gravity of what had happened. It wasn't a generation. It was generations.
Right.
And so what we're seeing and what you're talking about, the inevitable pendulum swing leftward, and God us alone knows, I hope you're right and you've got data behind you. It's a reason to be hopeful, depending upon one's age. I want to live to see that pendulum swing. And I want to see a permanent change to this country. But the question becomes one of, in the meantime, what do you do? You know, what are you doing in Alabama? You know, as horrifying as the anti-trans and anti-LGBTQ plus legislation is, the fact that they are so brazen, Allie, as to look at their own Supreme Court, whom they largely worship, who told them there shall be a second majority black district in Alabama, and said, no, we ain't going to do that. We're going to stand in the schoolhouse door again because it worked so good the last time.
It's unbelievable.
And it's cynical and it's ugly and it's spreading like a disease. I mean, it wasn't that long ago that I don't know how much you know about West Virginia, but, you know, up to the election of 2000, this state was as blue as California. Every member of the Board of Public Works, from the governor on down, Democrat, both senators, Democrats, every member of the House, Democrats, Democrats in the majority in the House of Delegates, in the Senate, and it's all just gone. And it's a hell, and I've watched it all happen, and it's terrifying. And so to loop back to what we were talking about originally, and you know, what do you do about the red states? What prospects do you see, and I don't mean to just whipsaw you around, Allie, but what prospects do you see in the good states? Let's stop saying blue. Let's say stay safe or good. And, you know, Aaron Reed's map that came out, last week? That was when we were talking about it. This every state that is red but not Florida. Florida's got hash marks through it. It just says, do not go. You know, abandon hope, all ye who enter here. Here be dragons. But I'm one of those red states that says risk high within 2 years. And I think that's optimistic on her part, because I think the risk is high within, let's see, this is September, October, November, December, January, within 5 months, because they will waste no time the minute they sit down in going after what they think is an easy target. And I've talked on this program over and over and over again about what it means to be a refugee. And it terrifies me, Allie. It absolutely terrifies me. Because I guess my nearest state would be Maryland. But it seems like all of these safe states, the cost of a cardboard refrigerator box over a storm drain is $1,200 a month. And so I guess the question I'm working toward is, to the extent that you have these refugee laws in place in places like California, etc., that speak to being unwilling to work with the anti-trans states and the anti-LGBTQ states, that's a good first step. But if, as you say, as much as 50% of the trans population in these red states are going to wind up being refugees, we're a tiny minority of the country, but that's still a substantial number of people. Is there any hope that there will be something more than legal protections, that there will be some means of, I can't see a refugee camp, but do you see where I'm going, Allie?
Yes, absolutely. And it's very important to draw attention to that. We can talk about the longer term hope and like the shorter term struggles that we're in. But 2028 is 5 years away. And who knows how long before, you know, the results of those elections would put in enough legal stuff, if even then, to reverse some of the damage. But more importantly, how much blood is shed between now and then? How many people do we lose because they couldn't get out? Or when they tried to get out, they ended up somewhere where they were homeless and exposed to, you know, much higher risks and succumbed. That's a big problem. And that's one that we can really only deal with through local organizing. There exists an organization in the United States that seeks to help bring trans refugees from abroad to get them out of bad and dangerous, you know, other parts of the world to here where they can be safe.
Yeah, shot on
city. We're going to have to build those same infrastructures here.
Exactly. I hope it's not an unfair comparison, but it feels a little bit like there is a desperate coming need for an actual underground railroad.
Absolutely, and it's not even a coming need. We need that now. There's already some hints of it that I've seen here and there. I've seen organizations try to get off the ground to provide that service. And, of course, the local community network of, you know, the unofficial network, where if you don't have actual nonprofits, but just people who reach out and offer their spare bedrooms and their couches and, you know, their pantries and so forth to fleeing people. That's already happening and has been for several years. In fact, I heard some of that back in 2016, 2017 when Trump first got elected. And that needs to continue and it needs to expand. The need is present today and it's only going to grow in the near term. We could see a few legislative or a few Supreme Court victories that reverse some of the trends, but it's going to be a long fight. And so we have to put in the work and the funds, the resources to try to save as many as we can while that fight is underway.
And it's everybody. The focus has been, by definition, and rightly so, on trans kids. You know, I remember the story of the parent and the child, the family, who literally had to sneak out of Texas in the dark and still of the night for fear of being pursued, and where for instance women's reproductive rights are concerned, you know, their latest tactic there in Texas has been to get communities to criminalize the use of the highway by women who might be leaving the state for reproductive care. Well, what we've seen is that the assault on reproductive care is easily transferable to other aspects of life that Republicans don't like. And so
100%. It is, they're tightly intertwined. One is for the purpose of the other as much as for its own sake.
I think you're absolutely right. I don't know if it's a matter of lobbying state houses, and you know, it's not just economic support, it's not just housing support, it's access to appropriate medical care. And I'm going to ask you a question. It might be a little bit too personal. I apologize if it is, but once you relocated to California, obviously you were dealing with your care on one level in Alabama, and you probably had to shift to some. Did you have any difficulty finding affirming continuing care once you got there?
I didn't. There's the LGBTQ Center has a gender health program, and UCLA has one as well, which consists of networks of doctors who specialize in trans care at all levels and share information with each other. So I actually have moved from some like individual doctors who were highly skilled and specialized in Mobile to now having, you know, rings of doctors for different purposes that can come together. It can be a little tough to get into some of it. Like the LGBTQ Center had months of backlog, but with UCLA, they had more doctors, and so I was able to find a doctor that I could get into reasonably quickly to keep my HRT going without a gap in having that.
and that's terrifying. You know, I do. This is just personal. I do injections, and Pfizer, my estradiol injectable, just disappeared, and don't know when it's going to come back. And I don't know if that has anything to do with the tornado that blew the bejesus out of that one plant in North Carolina. It was difficult before then, but it was terrifying for a while. And I was going between going back to dissolving pills in my mouth, and you know, then you know, okay, well, we got a month's worth of cream. We'll rub that on the inside of our arms for a while, and finally found a compounding pharmacy where I'm back on injections again. But huh, because the idea of going without is horrifying, pre or post, you know, or non for that matter. But I want to share a note that you just got. This comes from our dear friend Cynthia. She's up in the Bay Area. And she said, Allie's guest's experience, oh my goodness, can I ever relate? Imagine growing up in a fundamentalist church in the 60s. There's that rhyming again. Yes, I was afraid of being found out and feared for my own life if I were. I don't even have to say more. Oh, and what I will say is I sure wish I could have figured out a voice like hers. And I tried. She sounds perfect. Great voice. No one would ever guess or misgender her from her voice. Unlike me. Well, anyway, it's important for stories like Allie's to be told. Please keep telling it, because we aren't a lifestyle. This is our life, our reality. We were born this way. We didn't choose it. We didn't ask for it. We just are. I wish people could just understand that, says Cynthia. Any thoughts?
Yes, I have a lot of thoughts, different topics in that I would love to pick up on, starting with the last bit. You know, the more I think about this and the more I speak with those who have a low degree of understanding of LGBTQ issues in general, and reflecting on my experience coming out in a steel mill in rural Alabama and the questions that I got there, so much of this stems from one really simple misunderstanding about what sexual orientation is, I think. I mean, yeah, you have the haters, you have the people who are like religious fundamentalists who won't consider things, but there's a whole group of people beyond that. And this misunderstanding is based around this idea that your sexual orientation is based on actions. This seems like a tangent, but I promise it comes back around.
I trust you.
They think that someone is gay if that person does gay things. So you're straight until you go out and, you know, if you're a guy, you start dating men, that's when you become gay. As opposed to it being an integral part of who you are and being relative to attraction, to what traits in people that you find attractive and how those traits are either gendered or sexed in society. If you start with that fundamental misunderstanding that it's about actions, then so much of what's going on makes sense. A lot of the fear that they have about trans women is that a straight guy will be tricked into doing or thinking or feeling something gay by being attracted to a trans woman. This is why the trans women who are at the highest rates of violence, apart from those who are in poverty, the highest rates of like random violence, comes from those who are attractive enough to get attention and almost pass, or pass mostly, and then get found out. So a guy sees a trans woman, is attracted to her, then realizes she's trans, then reacts with violence. That's the number one cause of murder outside of those related to living in poverty for trans women. So if he, you know, what his reaction is there is that he's somehow being misled into something changing his sexual orientation against his will, which is not how any of this works. And if he understood that, then he wouldn't be bothered by that situation, because nothing about his identity would be threatened by someone else's existence. You also see the same thing reflected in all of the attitudes about trans youth and gay youth, right? If it's an action, then they think, this is why they say that it's all about, like, you know, the sexualization of youth. Because they don't think that you can be a gay youth without doing things that would qualify as being sexual acts. That's how they define being gay. They don't understand that it's an innate part of identity related to just your attraction that can come out, you know, when you're 10, 11 years old without doing anything, right? And if they understood that, then a lot of the issues that we are facing about, you know, what's going on in schools and libraries and youth organizations and all of this, it just wouldn't be as much of a thing. This is not true for those who are the ones organizing the demagoguing, of course. They will always look for wedge issues and ways that they can get in there. But it is true for a lot of the people that they are misleading, the people that they are bringing in, that they are roping in with their propaganda. They are exploiting that lack of understanding about this one simple core underlying thing.
And the way you explain it, it's not that complicated.
It's really not. That's why it's so frustrating. It's like it's a really simple concept if we could just sit down and explain it to people. But once it becomes politicized, you can't, because now you're just the enemy trying to mislead people. And that's why they're attacking having sexual orientation being taught as a concept in the school system, because they understand that if people are taught about this and what it means, they won't grow up with that misunderstanding. And then they're a lot harder to manipulate into hatred.
And honestly, it's kind of shocking when you run across it the first few times. Someone I know asked me a question. We were talking about trans adolescents and why acceptance is so important to their continued existence. And I said, because that's who they are. And every kid needs to be loved, not pigeonholed or punished or tried to put a round peg in a square hole or make them be someone they're not. Love the children, for God's sakes. And the response I got back, and it gobsmacks me to this day, is, well, why can't they just be gay till they turn 18?
Oh, gosh.
And, I mean, it did to me then what it's doing to me now. It's like, well, we're going to be unpacking this for a little bit.
Yeah. And that actually dovetails really nicely into the other thing that was in that message that I wanted to touch on, which was voice. Thank you so much for those compliments, by the way. This voice is a result of about a year of speech therapy. I spent close to $1,000 to get it. It works pretty well, I think, as well. I don't get clocked on my voice very often. Thank you so much. But because I didn't transition as a youth, I had to go through that, right? I had to get speech therapy to get this voice, and I only have this voice when I use those techniques. Now, they're kind of natural to me now, but if need be, I can switch.
You know, I can go down to here and have my radio voice if I want it.
Don't. Please, Allie, don't.
No, it's still there. It's still there.
Oh, I know.
It's not a good voice, right? This is not a good voice.
Oh, no. two years ago at the beach, I heard you Mongolian throat sing, and that's something I never want to hear again as long as I live. That's another thing I credit to you. I said, my God, because you were, you know, when we met, you were still working on it. And I said, how did you get that? That's wonderful. And he said, oh, just walk around saying, all the time for the rest of your life. That's all. But I
too much.
The struggle is real because, I mean, I've been doing this for 20 years, and there was a time when people said, you know, Robin, back then, you know, what his name was, you're the only person I know who makes James Earl Jones sound like Mickey Mouse. And back then, that was really cool. But as of, and by the way, day after tomorrow will be my third tranniversary.
Congratulations.
Thank you. So about 3 years ago, I began to understand. I hate making Confederate references, but there's a story that comes out of Gettysburg where, Jeb Stuart had been absent from the battlefield, and he'd been out running around and, you know, stealing horses and wagons. You know, what do you want from a Confederate cavalry commander? And after Lee had been whipped at Pickett's Charge on the final day, Stuart finally shows up with all these wagons. And he said, look at all these wagons I brought you, General. And Lee looks at him and says, fool,
they are impediments to me now.
And that's how I feel about my voice. You know, the voice that used to say, "This is CNN," is an impediment to me now. And it's hard to get shut of, and it takes a lot of work. And doing this for 3 hours a night, I can't maintain it. I cannot maintain it. This is about as good as I can get. But you know, when I'm out in the world, when sight and sound merge, it's a little bit easier, and it gets a little bit more Marilyn-ish and breathy. And and again, it's a matter of self-preservation, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. I went through this speech therapy before I came out at work, before I switched my presentation in person. It was part of the process of making sure that I could pass sufficiently to not have to be concerned with random violence.
Because in a way, I think...
Or I suppose, not random violence, but, you know, hate crime.
Yeah.
Specifically.
And because it's that dichotomy, I think, that triggers something, you know, back in the lizard brain, in the atavistic sense. And the more that we match, the better off we are. I've had experience... I was checking out at Kroger's one day, and I guess now it's just a little rap session. And the clerk looked at me, and bear in mind, I mean, we're talking about I'm in a pair of leggings, and you know, a top, and doing the best I can. It's fairly early, and she said, "You know, I learned about people like you watching RuPaul." And I said,
"Did you know?
What do you mean?" And she said, "Well, you know, you drag queens." I said. And again, you know, no ball gown, no outrageous eye makeup, nothing, no hair up to Jesus. And I said, oh, ma'am, we're not that. This doesn't come off. This is my life every day. I'm a trans woman. She said, what's that? And I'm not making fun of her, and she wasn't making fun of me.
No, right. It's like, it's the situation. Like, this is now your life, right?
And she was, you know, there's that old bumper sticker, you know, you can't fix stupid. She wasn't stupid. She was absolutely
right.
Unexposed, she was tabula rasa. She was terra incognita. And so we had a little conversation there at the checkout, and by the time I left, she knew the difference between a trans woman and a drag queen. Which, unlike what RuPaul said...
One conversation?
Yeah, all that was one conversation. And there's been a couple more of them. And they're a little invalidating, I can tell you that. But, you know, unlike what RuPaul said, the difference between a trans woman and a drag queen is not $20,000 worth of surgery. It's... But, you know, I could go, you know... Then again, RuPaul is a big fan of fracking and whatnot, so, you know, off to one side. But the
plus side is, you know, those conversations may have provided protection against this wave of indoctrination. That one little bit of understanding can provide enough defense that when the propaganda comes out, this isn't something that they're unexposed to, something they don't know anything about. This is something that they now have personal experience with, someone they connect with to. And there's nothing that provides a better defense to hatred than that one connection.
One hopes, but the thing that gets all over me is the cognitive dissonance involved, because, well, I don't know, that checkout clerk is a union member. Maybe she doesn't vote straight ticket Republican. But I know Republicans here, okay? And, I mean, look, it's West Virginia. As a dear friend of mine said to me once, stand in a group of 10 people, count off 7. They voted for Trump. Okay, and what drives me up a tree, and I'm grateful for the acceptance, because that's one of the other things. This is a blood red state. Alabama's a blood red state. I never, from the moment that I left in 2021, from the moment that, that we said our goodbyes and I left and headed headed up out of Gulf Shores with a hurricane named after my grandmother hot on my heels, wherever I stopped in that entire trip, never had a problem. Yes, ma'am. No, ma'am. Thank you, ma'am. And, you know, if we could do the whole Southern thing conversation, but you don't have time and I don't have time and it's just deep. But it was, you know, it was kind. It was polite. It was that way all the way through Tennessee, all the way through Kentucky. Actually, no, I left and I went back to Florida and then I went to Birmingham. So I went up through Virginia because that was when I had my first consult. Another little anniversary a couple of weeks ago. But I never had a problem. And I experienced that here. My big coming out and going full-time date is coming up on October 11th. And from the minute I came out and went full-time, I went full-time way too early. It was loving and accepting, and I had been here 20 years, and everybody knew who I was in the before time. They're like, oh, you're a girl now? Yeah, okay, yes, you are. And I have fabulous, really, Robin? I have wonderful cis girlfriends. I have, well, all my girlfriends are cis. I'm a unicorn. I'm a butterfly. I'm a coelacanth, for Christ's sakes. And everybody, the girl coming, and it's total acceptance. I was blown away and made so happy and felt so at ease. But the thing, Allie, that just gets all over me like fire ants is the fact that I know that 7 out of 10 of these people walk into a voting booth who would not say an unkind word to me or about me and vote for people who go to Charleston and spend the legislative session trying to advance a bill to make it a felony for me to go grocery shopping and be seen by a kid. How do you square that?
How can you ever? There's so many factors at play, and they're all, there's a Southern politeness where people who hate you will pretend to be super nice. There's single issue voters and identity voters who have no idea what's going on.
Oh my God! And they're here. I don't
care who you are or how you identify. I just don't want to get my guns.
Exactly.
And I said, well.
And the polling has shown that, like, until the past year or two, attitudes among Republicans about trans people weren't that awful. I mean, they weren't great, but they weren't terrible either. It was not a winning issue, even within the party. It wasn't something that most voters cared about. It was polling at somewhere around 15% of people that considered it a top important issue in the entire party. This has been a AstroTurf hate campaign designed to create and manufacture outrage. And it has taken a while to get going. You know, they started with bathrooms and that didn't work because people saw through it. So they moved to child athletic sports competitions where they actually found, oh, here's a wedge issue where we have the majority support. 80% of the country believes that trans women should be restricted from competing in athletic events. So this is how we get our foot in the door. And they got their foot in the door with that issue, and they rebranded the issue. Instead of trans girls competing against cisgender girls in high school, they reframed it as boys who are competing against girls. That didn't get resistance because 80% agreed with the goal, so they just went along with it. But then that narrative settled in, and it wasn't hard to pivot from that to outlawing medical care, even including mental health care for trans youth, because they had successfully reframed them as, you know, not being validly transgender, but rather being the gender they were assigned at birth.
Biologically male. Sure. Yeah. I'm so sick of that term. I am so sick of that term. It makes me go up a wall. Biologically this or biologically that. Well, tell me, Superman, when you get your X-ray glasses on, what you see in my chromosomes. And then there's chromosomal sex, because they lost on biological male, they lost on what is a woman. They keep losing and losing and losing. And the thing that blows my mind, Allie, is that the polling data coming out of 2022, you know, which was supposed to be their big red wave, said that all these trans issues that they spent all this money on in all these states mattered to less than 5% of the voters, Republican voters.
They don't care.
And nobody was coming out to the polls on that. But they're gonna do it again. I have no doubt of it. You know, as far as the
they absolutely will.
And
I think they have to. This is something that the ideological leadership understands. The people who are creating the agendas, who are creating the AstroTurf movements and the propaganda messaging, who are determining all of this. They're the reason that they picked trans people to go after and to go so hard on this issue, to the point of losing elections to do it. Like, it has cost them elections, and they're still doubling, tripling down on it. And my theory behind that is just my personal opinion. I don't have a copy of an email from somebody admitting that this is the case for them. But I think they are aware that trans acceptance across broader society, especially including the umbrella definition of transgender, which would include various non-binary, agender, two-spirit, and other culture identities for gender. Accepting that means the end of the power structures that they rely upon for their entire movement. That's the end of patriarchy. You cannot enforce patriarchy if you don't apply that from birth and attach it to fundamental unchangeable characteristics. The moment you permit the existence of transgender people, of people to essentially tell the world what their identity is and what their gender is, you can no longer prescribe to them the roles that they have in society. Without patriarchy, without all of the systems that connect to that, they're everything that they are trying to establish in this country becomes impossible. It's one of the cornerstones of fascism in general.
Yes.
And it's why you see the same groups of people who go after trans people are just as aggressive about feminism.
Sure.
Because it's the exact same issue for them.
Well, I mean,
they're not wrong that this is a threat to their way of life.
Yeah, and I'm here for that. I want to be a threat to fascism's way of life. Because,
100%.
Because not 2 miles up the road, every a couple of times a year, I go up and visit my uncle, whom I never met, who died making life hard for fascists. And I feel like I'm in pretty good company under those circumstances. And there's another uncle, actually he's a second cousin, who did the same thing at the Battle of the Bulge, and he's about 20 miles down the river. So, okay, fine. Don't like fascists. Good. And, hey, let's remember that whether it be the Confederacy or the Third Reich, the last flag they ever flew was just a white flag of surrender. And I want to see that son of a gun fluttering in the breeze again. And I got to share another note with you. Matt in San Francisco, subject line, drag queens, said, I only went to a supermarket in drag once. The party thrower needed ice. I'm not spending 3 hours of tucking, padding, and makeup to go to the checkout at Kroger's. Signed, Matt. Who, in my before time, I referred to as the den mother of the horn. Thank you, Matt. I mean, that's validation. Yeah, that's a lot of work. And I got no time for that either. One of the things I'm learning to do here is not do an hour of makeup just to go up to the Rippy Mart. Sometimes all the other women around here don't have to do that. Why I gotta? So I'm working with my therapist, and it's okay, Robin. You can do that. But by the same token, there's that whole thing of, there's not a lot of, but I'm actually doing it, following her, and lo and behold, I still get the yes ma'ams and the no ma'ams and the thank you ma'ams. And one of the nicest parts, you mentioned southern so-called politeness, is that my cis girlfriends, when they say, you know, I know they're not just being nice to my face because I get messages saying, hey, we're going to go on dancing. Can you come out? Yes, please. So there's that. Wow, we have been all over the place. And I thank you for this hour of your life that you have so kindly given me. And, you know, I'm out here rooting for you. It's nice just to sit around and yak sometimes. And actually, yeah, I talk about these issues here. But it's nice not to be the only voice talking about them. And the perspective that you bring is so informed. You know, you've done all your homework. Whereas, you know, I get wrapped up in other crap, you know, court cases and the stuff that just, but it all touches us too. You know, the progress that may be made after 2024 and 2028. I don't know how long Clarence Pubes on the Coke can Thappy Thomas is going to stay alive, or Sammy Bad Breath Alito. I don't know how long The Handmaid's going to be sitting on that bench holding women back, all of us. And so the more voices we add to the conversation, the better off we are. And like I said, I just thank you, and I appreciate you, and I want every good thing in the world for you. And I hope you know I'm not the only one that has to stay safe. You stay safe too, Allie.
I will. And thanks so much for having me. This has been an absolute delight, and happy to add my voice anytime.
Okay, thank you. Then I will probably abuse our friendship. You take care.
Okay.
Okay. Bye. And that is my dear sister, Allie, happily ensconced in Southern California, reasonably safe. And may it be so for all of us. I don't mean just trans people. I mean all of us. We got a little saying here, and you'll see it around the South. Y'all, Y'ALL, means all. Y'all means all. So again, thank you, Allie. And all the best. All the best. Now, that said, since it is prayer meeting Wednesday, I got a story, and it dovetails with what Allie and I were talking about, and it is perfect, frankly, for prayer meeting Wednesday. Story comes from News Channel 5 in Cleveland. Gets so tiresome. The me saying it's a prayer meeting Wednesday story probably gives away. Well, no, I don't think it's that easy to guess which religion anymore, so maybe not. Catholic Diocese of Cleveland's new policy rejects transgender people, same-sex couples. Y'all means all, right? Oh, and by the way, I didn't get around to mentioning it. I should have. My sister Terry, who knows Allie very well. Terry introduced me to Allie, and in January of 2021. And if you see my photographs, you'll see me wearing it a lot. It's a little sparkly butterfly necklace. Terry sent that to me. And prior to her giving me one, she had one for herself. And Allie has the third one. Little butterfly sisterhood. And I should have made mention of that, but it just now occurred to me. Sweet. Those two women have done so much to bring me along, and I have so far to go. But I've been uplifted by more people than I can count. And not just trans people. Cis people as well. Uplifted by the other initials in the LGBTQ plus community. And I'm forever grateful. And it's one of those, if we do not stand together, we shall surely hang separately things. Hence the headline out of Cleveland. Catholic Diocese of Cleveland's new policy rejects transgender people and same-sex couples. The reporter for News Channel 5 in Cleveland, ABC News, is Morgan Trowell, who writes, the Catholic Diocese of Cleveland, this would be the same Roman Catholic Church that to this day has a problem getting their priests to stop fucking little boys. I just wanted to mention that in case anybody forgot. The Catholic Diocese of Cleveland created a new policy around gender identity and sexuality, and more than 80 schools around Northeast Ohio will have to follow what the diocese calls in the document God's intent. Wrong accent, Robin. God's intentional design. Well, let's just start there because that's easy. God's intentional design. Thanks, God, for that appendix. No, really. Really, thanks. Thanks for my... I'm pretty sure that the serpent who talked... who got all chatty with Eve and talked her into taking a bite of some fruit that was or was not an apple. The apple originated in Iran, so... that probably means that... Oh, dear God, the Garden of Eden was in Iran. Help! Never mind. I'm pretty sure that the serpent didn't give humanity an appendix. Or wisdom teeth. Or diabetes. Or nearsightedness or farsightedness. Or cancer. Or spina bifida. Or any of a number of the ailments and diseases to which the flesh is heir. Now, we are taking for this prayer meeting Wednesday purpose the notion that there is even an iota of factuality to the babblings of a bunch of dudes somewhere around 2,500, 2,600, 2,700 years ago who decided to write down some myths and fables that they'd heard about a guy named Moses. Moses, Moses, Moses. Who is this Moses? I am thinking this Moses shall have been a fool. Can't say Moses without quoting Yul Brynner and The King and I. But assuming that there's any factuality to it at all, yeah, thanks. And as Mark, I'm stealing from Mark Twain now, thanks, almighty creator of with an intentional design for the tsetse fly. Thank you for the hookworm. Hey! I know it's a fairly modern vintage, but thanks for COVID-19, your godness. It's a dumb question, and it's entirely rhetorical. But how can a bunch of guys running away, running around in dresses that I wouldn't be caught dead in, that RuPaul would not be caught dead in. There's a difference. We talked about it. Wearing House of Whoville hats. How is it that they are competent in the least? Oh, by the way, who think that they're not supposed to have sex, whom we sincerely wish would have sex with adults. How are they competent to tell 26 religious schools, you know, if it was 26 madrasas, this would be an entirely different story. How is it, and see, this is tied up with money, too. This whole God's intentional design business is also part of a concerted effort. And, we have a number of people in Ohio. Hi, Kat. Hi, Joey. Hi, Dennis. Hi, Jake. And lots more. Trey, hi. Kay, are you in Ohio now? And I'm sure I'm leaving out names, but just off the top of my head. What they want, and it's always what they want, these madrasas, let's see if that changes the dynamic. They want public school money from the state of Ohio to be given to religious indoctrination centers passing themselves off as schools, madrasas. Barack Hussein Obama went to a madrasa in the Philippines. Remember that? Because I do. And so, what a toxic, loathsome convergence. Because, you know, if the religious schools can do this, and there's already a move afoot to do something similar in the public schools, it's already been done in other states, and, you know, as ever, Ohio is a battleground. Stop saying Ohio, Robin. Pisses people off. Blame it on Steve. Well, again, it's not just about the transes. It's about all the queers. So this lengthy piece of hateful, everything phobic garbage says that students have to, and this is where it gets really interesting. Students have to act and dress as their God-given biological sex. And they're not allowed to behave inconsistently with their sex assigned at birth. I feel like we've been down this road before. And I don't know how it is in Ohio, but I grew up in Alabama. Steve just heard. Where were you, Steve? Steve just heard. Blame it on Steve. Ohio. You're the one that got me saying Ohio. Granted, you later ameliorated to the Buckeye State, but still, stuck in my brain. It's your fault. I think it's funny that Steve got on. Wait, what? She said blame it on Steve. What the fuck have I done now? But down south where I grew up, there was coded language. The South always has coded language. And if a boy was perceived as not being just overwhelmingly masculine, if he's not twirling his handlebar mustache by the time he's seven, during parent-teacher conferences, the teacher will say, well, you know, Robin is so sensitive and so intelligent. I have no idea why I used my own name in that. Oh, yes, I do. And there's, you know, and within the binary, there's the other side of it. You know, I don't know why Janie can't wear a dress. I don't know why Ellie Mae won't put on a dress. I swear every time I turn around, she's got a pair of knee breeches on and a gingham check shirt, and she's up a tree somewheres. She can outrun and outfight any boy in the neighborhood. No tomboys either in 26 Catholic schools in Ohio, I suppose. No sensitive, intelligent boys. Well, there we are again. What Allie said comes true. More of that rhyming. Micah says, sensitive and intelligent. She adds, in fact, I was always told I was too sensitive. Fuckers. World could use more of that. And you know, that's that Southern politeness Allie was referring to. God knows she was dipped by the heel in it, just like me. And so the teachers... The teachers were lovely ladies, and they were church-going folk back then. Probably, and they still are, but they'd say, yeah. Sensitive. So smart. Not like the other boys. Which was as gently as they could explain to the parents, I don't think you're going to be having grandkids. Or something along those lines. Anything to not say, you know, I think your child is a homosexual. And again, I don't know why I go to the Richard Pryor voice for that. So, the policy goes on and says, this means... No singing. We are $1,440 in the hole. We got a challenge on the table. It would get us down to 1,390, and I don't know if this program is going to be here tomorrow. I was going to say, should I sing this like a church high mass? This means that every person is expected to refrain from acting in a manner the purpose of which is to hold themselves out as being a sex or gender that is inconsistent with the person's God-given biological sex or... No. This means that every person is expected to refrain from acting in a manner and for the purpose of which is to hold themselves out as being a sex or gender that is inconsistent with the person's God-given biological sex or which, regardless of intent, has the effect of causing confusion or scandal regarding the person's sex or gender relative to the person's God-given biological sex. Imagine being a religion that follows a brown-skinned Palestinian day laborer and semi-literate itinerant rabbi who wore a dress every day of their life, whom their own religion says is neither male nor female, but is everything all wadded up in one, who went on and said, if anyone would hurt any of these little ones, it would be better that a millstone were put around their neck and they were dropped into the bottom of the ocean. Who said, suffer the children to come unto me, for of them is the kingdom of God. Imagine claiming to support and follow all of that and at the same time saying that children, can cause, what was it? Confusion or scandal. Well, let them grow out of it. I tell you what, you know what? I know he's sensitive. I know. Hell, he's a sissy. You send him out for the football team. Yeah, we always needing scrubs here at St. Tallywhackers. We'll put him on the practice squad. Rough him up a little bit. Blindside him a few times, and that'll bring out the man in him. It'll make him mean. You got to be mean. We'll give them some spinal cord and brain injuries for them to enjoy in their later years. Yeah, I know. No, we heard all about what happened in Woodshop. Little feller about sawed his pinky off. The way he's going, how's he going to get through life without one of them? Yeah, no more of them damn math classes, and get him out from behind the damn computer. Get him out on the practice field. Football builds character. Wow, this is beginning to feel a little bit autobiographical. So, children can cause confusion and scandal. Are the words they're really looking for embarrassment? Or a threat? To, say, 1,700 years of homophobia, queerphobia, and misogyny? What else is in this nightmare for children that go to these godforsaken schools? And I mean godforsaken. No gender transitioning or ability to use gender-affirming care while in the schools. Like Allie noted, that's up to and including mental health care. You know, mental health care that might help one of these poor, tormented souls who has to be in one of these shithole schools from unaliving themselves. No acceptance. No exceptions. No one can advocate or celebrate the LGBTQ+ community, including displaying the pride flag or rainbows. It's going to be a little rough on the book of Genesis, isn't it? And God placed a bow in the sky as a promise that he would never again destroy all of humanity in a flood. How will that read now? And God placed a thing in the sky that definitely does not partake of the prism colors of red, orange, yellow, green, blue, indigo, and violet. Roy G. Biv. In the sky, which definitely did not cause any confusion or scandal. And there will be, in the name of Jesus, no same-sex couples at dances or similar events. Schools will use discretion to allow a platonic friend to attend a dance. No hand-holding, you old perverts. Platonic, huh? Platonic. You know, Plato, Socrates, Plato's teacher, murdered by the Athenian democracy, some 300 years before Yeshua, the brown-skinned Palestinian day laborer and itinerant semi-literate rabbi who wore a dress every day of their life, emerged from his mama's loins. No, he didn't. She never had sex. She was a virgin until the day she died. Who believes this? How? Platonic friend. And you know, probably, I forget which Catholic theologian who was counting angels dancing on pinheads, and by that we mean cardinals. Never mind. Said it, but no, they grandfathered Aristotle in, and Plato. Socrates never wrote a lick, so he didn't really have to be grandfathered in. Yeah, no, but the Holy Mother Church grandfathered in Aristotle and Plato as proto-Christians. Because some of the tenets that they espoused, knowledge, the unexamined life is not worth living. Well, they were handy to the church at one point. Ralphs, don't confuse them. But Robin, Jesus had brothers. Yeah, didn't they throw James off a building? Yeah. I don't know. She and Joseph adopted. Best I got. By the way, Ralph said, "Come on, people, don't make me sick Lassie on y'all." God, I don't think Lassie's strong enough to carry a rope heavy enough to enough rope to get that far down the well. Randy Radar said, "I dare say there was a manservant or two in the Bible." Oh, there was. There was. And David loved Jonathan as he loved, as though it were his own heart. Ever wonder why Saul got so mad? I think I know. Let's see, what old Platonic? No preferred pronoun usage other than the sex assigned at birth. This is going to create real havoc for those English teachers in these madrasas. At least the ones trying to teach English as it's been spoken since about the 15th century or thereabouts. Because that's how long they and them and their has been used in a singular form when the person being referred to is indeterminate. It's all over the place in Shakespeare. Damned English major. Each individual must use the bathroom or facilities that corresponds with their sex assigned at birth. What are they going to do about the intersex kids? Because when we talk about this, I don't want to leave the intersex kids out. Because whatever some doctor having slapped a baby's bottom, they don't really do that anymore. Well, maybe the Catholic doctors do. While the priest gets to watch. The doc looks and goes, girl or boy. But the thing is, what they're looking at is not determinative. Because there are so many different chromosomal differences that it doesn't really tell anything. You got a redheaded friend? Well, it's white now, but you do. Me. True redheads in the culture, in the global population, I should say, not the culture. True redheads exist at about the same percentage as intersex people. People assumed to be girls but have undescended testes instead of ovaries. androgen insensitivity syndrome, Klinefelter syndrome. There's a lot of them. But whatever assumption Dr. Thumbfingers made at birth is going to determine where somebody goes pee-pee, because Holy Mother Church is terribly, terribly, terribly concerned with where people go pee-pee in the name of Jesus. If a school is single-sex, trans children who are now that gender are not allowed to attend. I don't even know what that means. Do you? A little help here? So it's an all-boys school. It's an all-boys school. And someone who identifies as a boy but was assumed female at birth. Let's say an intersex person. Can't go to that school. Because it'll make Jesus cry. You know what makes Jesus cry? At least, you know, if you buy into it, again, that we're working from that all the way through this. We're working with that paradigm. What really upset Jesus, apart from just generally being shit to little kids, maybe Jesus remembered being bullied. Or according to the Apocrypha, maybe Jesus himself had repented of the fact that he was a bully. If you've done it unto the least of these, you've done it also unto my brothers. Or you've done it also unto me. If you've done it unto these, you've done it unto me. If you've not done it unto these, you've not done it to me. So being cruel to kids, like this is literally, and I'm talking about Roman Catholic Church teaching, making Jesus sad. But, you know, there's church teaching and there's church teaching, right? This is a dandy. Only single-sex sports teams, except girls, can join boys' teams when deemed appropriate. So, once again, further proof that it's the trans girls they're worrying about, that they're upset about, that they're nauseated by, that they have an atavistic response to. So we will let's say, the 8th grade girl join the boys' wrestling team. And it's okay if she whips every boy's ass and maybe goes to the state championships and wins that too in her weight class. On the other hand, a 7th grade boy can't play field hockey? Can't run cross country? At a time when the difference between the two between the two genders is negligible at best. And then, just to make sure that the kids can be tortured not just in school but out of school, the Diocese of Cleveland says that if, God forbid, some child in that shithole school questions their gender, the school shall, in the name of Jesus, rat them out so that they can be tortured by the parents who claim to love them. I'm sorry, I said 26 schools. I was so wrong. There are 106 schools in the Catholic Diocese of Cleveland. But the number of directly impacted schools from this nightmare this exercise in vulgarity, bigotry, and hate in the name of Jesus is 79 elementary schools and 5 high schools. I don't know where New Richmond, Ohio is, but I don't like the people who live there, or at least I don't like a majority of them, because they sent a bigot named Adam Bird to the State House in Columbus.
Well, they need a way to protect traditional family values. They need a way to protect their children.
Well, Representative Adam Bird, when they walk into the bedroom one day and find their child hanging with a belt around their neck from the rack in their closet, I wonder how they're going to feel about how well they protected their children, Representative Bird. Or when one of the children, because this happened in Ohio a few years back, when one of the tormented children simply steps in front of a bus or a truck and leaves a note that says, please change things, please make my death mean something. Well, don't worry, that's a suicide, so the child's not going to get a Christian burial in a Catholic graveyard, Representative Bird. And what's worse, Representative Bird is the chair of the Primary and Secondary Education Committee and says,
well, the diocese is trying to promote traditional family values, and same-sex couples at a dinner, at a dance, does not represent family values.
You know, because same-sex couples definitely never have families. Because little Jenny never has two mommies. And little Bobby never has two daddies. Ever. 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 Well, thank you, Ken. Thank you so much. Ken up in Northwest PA just said, hey, I'm going to meet Ralph's auntie and raise it by $25. Thank you. So that means we've gone down to $1,365. Roughly the same era where this church doctrine is coming from. Thank you, Ken. A little bit more and feel pretty good about having a show on the air tomorrow. Appalachian Power wants $400. And so that's 75 of it. 325 to go. Cynthia, thank you so much. Hey, Cynthia. Robin, you're way more than just coming along. You're like postdoc in transition life now, damn close to your PhD. In fact, your thesis is perfectly defended. Dr. Professor Robin. That's Frau Dr. Professor Robin. Thank you, Cynthia. Thank you so much. I'm giving you a cowbell. And Cynthia adds, when I have to go pee, I have to go pee. Would you rather I went in the toilet, or pee on the seat in the airport that you may sit on next after my flight takes off? I can't hold it forever. I personally am in favor of children there in the Diocese of Cleveland peeing on the shoes of priests and nuns. But, you know, I'm cranky that way. Well, thank you. From Hawaii, we're down to 1355, which is still in line with this doctrine or bullshit, whatever, from the Diocese of Cleveland. Thank you. To a to a different Cynthia. Thank you. From another person in Hawaii. I hope you're okay. Jesus' brothers, says Stephen, New York, most on-the-ground Catholics and I just ignore the bishops on LGBTQ plus matters. Honestly, so does the Pope. That being said, I feel I have a weird obligation, not sure why, honestly, to clarify something. There's no reference in the Bible or any pre-biblical apocryphal to Jesus' brothers. The term brother is in James. Jesus' brother is a mistranslation. The term for brother and half-brother and cousin, etc., it's all the same words in Aramaic and Hebrew, etc. Given the belief that Mary being a perpetual virgin far predates the establishment of the canon, the term in the Bible is translated consistent with what the interpretation is. The problem we run into there, Steve, is the fact that, yeah, canon, and the reference to Jesus' mother being a virgin, that first crops up in the New Testament not within the span of time of people who actually, knew him, or much of anybody else. The Synoptic Gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, I think first, and its source document, which is referred to simply as Q, shows up around 72 of the Common Era. And if we assume that Yeshua was murdered along about 33 or so of the Common Era, then that's 40 years later. And of course, we have no copy of Q. And any reference to and the oldest books in the New Testament are the letters, not legends. Are the letters attributed, and some of them are consistent enough that we can say, yeah, they had a single author. Others wrote in Paul's name. But the Pauline letters, the earliest of the Pauline letters, are within maybe 7 or 8 years of the murder of Yeshua. And the problem is, Paul never says a word, not a peep, not a syllable, about Mary being a virgin. And that word, virgin, is also a mistranslation, because the Aramaic and the Hebrew is Alma, I believe, which has nothing whatsoever to do with whether a woman has been penetrated by a penis. And everything to do with her relative age. It means young girl. And frankly, in that era, young girls, well, they didn't stay unsexed for very long. In fact, even boys, them neither. Because, well, you know how we were talking about the boys that were called sensitive and so smart? Well, Yeshua may have been one of those. Because it was downright socially and culturally bizarre to the point of embarrassment for a little Jewish boy of that era, of about 14 to 16, not to have already had his matrimony arranged and celebrated and sent off with an alma. So I get your point, Steve, but there's so many inconsistencies. I don't know which ones we can hang our hats on. And when they were asked why they needed to come out with this hateful piece of awful OFFAL, I will never use that in a speech again without spelling it just like I did. The speech-to-text translator is something I said at the West Virginia legislature. Translated as a piece of legislative awful, A-W-F-U-L, which I guess is close, but it really is an awkward usage. But when asked why they felt compelled to put together this piece of theocratic awful, the diocese said,
well, it's because of societal trends.
Because they didn't want to use the term social contagion. Jesus. And this goes back to representing Byrd, who doesn't care how many little trans kids wind up hanging from the rack in their closets. He said,
I want to help solve the problem that's come from the confusion that's being created from those who are part of this trans cult.
Oh, you dickweed. It's not a cult. Maybe the religion you practice is. And he added that the public schools are becoming too progressive. They're selling insurance? So, I told you there was an intersection. Cherchez l'argent. Find the money. That's when Adam Byrd said the quiet part out loud. The church putting forward these policies is a good incentive for the voucher system. Because in Ohio, there's something called the Ed Choice Voucher. Hi, Ed. Hi. And it says that parents will be given state money to use in religious indoctrination camps calling themselves schools. And according to the latest Ohio budget, even if you are a multimillionaire family, you still get tuition money from the state to send your children to these horrific and torturous indoctrination camps. So that in turn means that the state of Ohio will be funding every bit of the hate inside this god-awful document. Byrd went on and said, public schools being part of this trans cult that is occurring is not reality. Oh, you shit weasel, I promise you I'm real. And so are the rest of us. Trans guys, trans girls, non-binary people. I mean, we have reflections in mirrors and everything. Not so sure about you. How about some garlic, bub? At least according to News Channel 5, the folks in Northeast Ohio that they talked to weren't cool with the idea. Cameron Mays, a resident of Brecksville, said, Catholic means universal. Shouldn't that universal aspect include every person? Let the kids explore what they want to explore and do what they want to do. Danica Van Horn told News Channel 5, the LGBTQ plus community does deserve care. I think people have a right to say who they are and what they are and how they feel. Cameron Mays had more to say. He said, there's no hope for any organized religion if they don't become open for everyone on this earth. Mays is a practicing Catholic, by the way. He's going to keep practicing till he gets it right. He said, it's their own funeral. And there's truth in that. Because what they're guaranteeing, because it's not these kids. I don't know what we're caught. I mean, if you're in seventh or eighth grade, what have we named that generation? Because like Allie said, in 2024, Gen Z will be 30. But these kids are growing up together. And they don't hate each other for the most part. One of the most inspiring things I saw during the legislative session in West Virginia last February and March was showing up for rallies at the Capitol and seeing cis kids standing right next to their LGBTQ friends, colleagues, and schoolmates and saying, "Leave my friends alone, you horrible grown-ups." And none of those kids are going to want anything to do with the Pope at Rome or bishops or priests. And some of those cis kids may be the ones that Father Aloysius is fucking. And that doesn't help much either. Oh, dear me, I was wondering, going back to Plato and Aristotle now. Hi, Matt. Let's do the cowbell. How did they separate the men from the boys in ancient Greece? With a crowbar. Try the veal. Don't forget to tip your server. Matt will be here all night. All week. Missed you the last couple of nights, Matt. I was actually a little bit worried about you. I need a giggle. God knows I need the giggles. Part deux, Steve says, I will explain on Friday if anyone still cares at that point. On the brother front, you have a Protestant, God gave the world the Bible and sola scriptura perspective. The Roman Catholic Church's view is not that God gave the world the Bible, it's the other way around. The RCC does not take its cues from the Bible in the same way. Oh, believe me, I learned a lot about that growing up. There were horrible conflicts when I was young, because church league basketball, without fail, because you know it's Alabama, so you got church league basketball. I'm sure they got it everywhere, other places too. But Holy Joe's always fielded the most badass basketball team. And the really good players wanted to play for Holy Joe's and not Darby Drive Church of Christ and get thumped. And there were actual sermons preached from the pulpit about not going over there and playing for the Mary worshipers. And those were the nice references. I want to clarify again, Steve says, this LGBTQ plus policy is awful because it harms so many kids and because such a high percentage of priests and nuns are gay. For that reason alone, the people on the ground will wipe their butts with it. They do so in my church. And I agree. I got no disagreement with you, Steve. But here's the question. What of the 79 elementary schools and 5 high schools? They're not closing down. They love that secular treasury money. Because the church has always, well, remember, the love of money is the root of all evil, y'all. But those schools have kids in them. There was a headline today in the Charleston Gazette Mail about how Charleston Catholic just turned 100 years old. So kids are in those schools, and what about them? I mean, you're paying money and getting help from the state, and the Diocese of Cleveland says, don't you send your sensitive little boys here, or at least make them be a little bit butch. Can you at least try? We're not going to have boys making googly eyes at other boys. That's for the priest to do. And we don't want to hear about no little girls holding hands on the playground or nothing. If every little girl I grew up with who held hands with another girl in elementary school turned out gay, but again, we're talking about people with filthy minds. Just filthy minds. So I thought that story deserves some attention on a prayer meeting Wednesday. We got some good political conversation in the first hour. Let me check before we wrap the program up. Oh, by the way, the Trump administration's own lawyers said that an impeachment inquiry ain't valid. It's not a thing. As I said in yesterday's post, impeachment inquiries and snipes are in the same category. Things that do not exist. Well, this is certainly stupid. In addition to celebrating the decision not to run for another term in the Senate by Bishop Willard Romney, Nitwit Nero also ran off to Tripe Social to send out a tripe to get mad at the King of Pop? Y'all, I don't know if he could handle that man, woman, person, camera, TV thing again this time. And he's also worked up about the Panama Canal?
Such dishonesty at the failing New York Times. Recently, I did an interview with Tokyo Rose Carlson. He toasted my testicles for me. It was great.
I added that part.
Rather than the debate, which turned out to have more views.
A little problem with the English language here. I'm trying to figure out who had the more views. Debate, which turned out to have more views, tends to indicate that the more views modifies debate, not Tucker Carlson. God knows Tucker Carlson could use some modification.
Such dishonesty at the failing New York Times. Recently, I did an interview with Tucker Carlson rather than the debate, which turned out to have more views at 265 million than any interview ever done. The debate had 11 million. Second was the famous Oprah interview of Michael Jackson, which did far less.
Leave Michael alone! I'm not going to, I don't care how loopy this sounds, I'm not going to go back and view it. I like my brain cells. Because he said,
during the interview, I talked about the Panama Canal and how we so stupidly sold it back to Panama for $1. Very sarcastically mimicking crooked Joe Biden and how truly lost he is.
Yeah, that whole appropriation, colonialism. By the way, the pageant, it wasn't debate, had 12.8 million viewers. And, no, there were not 265 million views of his stupid little conversation with Tucky O'Rose.
Good Lord.
Will no one rid us of this meddlesome marshmallow? Oh, and the case filed in court to bar Nitwit Nero from the Colorado ballot.
So much losing.
A judge said, "Nah, we're not going to move this case to federal court for you, Donnie." Chief U.S. District Judge Philip A. Brimmer said, "Back to state court with you in Denver County." Brimmer was a W appointee. And he said, "You didn't even manage to serve the Secretary of State correctly. And the law says you have to have her consent to move it to federal court, and you didn't even try to get it." Brimmer said, "Because Secretary Griswold accepted service before Mr. Trump moved the case." Oh, called him Mr. Trump, too. Ouch.
I hate it when they call me Mr.
"Because Secretary Griswold accepted service before Mr. Trump removed the case and she did not join in or consent to removal, the court finds that removal was defective." The losses are humiliating. He's got nothing left but complaining about Michael Jackson and the Panama Canal. Are there people out there that are eating this up with a spoon? And since we started, kinda, with Bishop Willard, let's finish with Bishop Willard. Let's start with the audio.
Now, I saw an article in The Atlantic which pointed out that young people are not warming to the MAGA message, and I think that's true. Whether Donald Trump is there, there will be someone that follows him, that follows in his footsteps and gives the same populist patter. I don't think it'll be successful long term, because I think young people are paying far more attention, are not going to be sucked into the populist notions. And so I think our party goes back to, if you will, the wise wing of the Republican Party as time goes on.
Do you think your party, though? I mean,
is that wise or white?
Dominating in the polls right now is probably going to be your nominee. You're on the outlier of the party.
Yeah.
There's no signs that what you're saying, that the party's going to shift away.
I'm not talking about the next 2 years. I'm talking over the next decade or so. I mean, I mean, populism doesn't work. I quote that M.L. Mencken line, which is, "To every complex problem, there's a solution which is simple, clear, and wrong." And unfortunately, that's what we're hearing. And again, on the Trump wing of the party, I haven't heard policy. Other than saying we're going to build a wall. And by the way, he was president. He was president for 4 years. He built 50 miles. What did he get done? Or he said, "Well, how about the tax change?" Well, the tax, that was Paul Ryan. That wasn't the Biden plan. He did, of course, he had a health care plan. Remember that? That was going to, everyone was going to have low-cost health insurance that was fabulous. Never proposed. Never saw. He was in 4 years. So it's not a policy-centric approach. And if you don't have policy to match your rhetoric, ultimately, it's not going to be.
I mean, I hate to say that, but Bishop Willard is wrong. His party is dying. The thing that sort of confuses me is what replaces the Republican Party. We've seen that in the short run, it's been replaced by full-throated, jackbooted fascism. But once it's dead, once those demographic changes Allie was talking about take place, Well, nature and politics abhor a vacuum. Is the Republican Party going to be propped up by nothing more than the pale, thin, gruel underpinnings of the Supreme Court? Is the Republican Party just going to be the Confederacy with a couple of added weirdos in? I sincerely don't know. Yeah, I noticed that Suman in Arizona says, Romney almost said populist crap and caught himself. Yeah, they wouldn't think much of that at the temple out there in Salt Lake City. You can't say crap, Willard. Steve in New York said, prepare for a huge fucking guffaw when there aren't even the votes in the House to impeach Biden. Well, there aren't. That's why they can't have a vote. That's why this is an impeachment inquiry. Those GOP districts where Biden trounced Trump, 17 of them, will likely not vote for impeachment. At that point, cue the huge fucking guffaw. They're engaging in about the only squirrel moment that will make the for-profit media stop harping on Joe's age. As Steve also observed, rightly, I think, the Panama Canal and Joe Biden? Huh? What exactly do these things have to do with one another? Oh, now I get it. He meant Hunter was involved in selling the canal back for a dollar. You know, when he was 3? Or a gleam in his daddy's eye? Oh, that's how it's Joe's fault. Got it. Takes some serious brain sweat sometimes, Steve. All right, that's it. Even a little bit overtime. It's been a prayer meeting Wednesday, hasn't it? Thanks so much for coming along. Thanks so much for sharing your thoughts. Thanks for listening and perceiving, comprehending, and caring on all of these topics. Thank you. Thank you. Thanks to our PayPal and Patreon subscribers. Thanks to our a la carte contributors and challenge makers. Thanks to each and every one of you who share your precious finite time engaging in the program in whatever manner you so choose. Thanks to our all-volunteer staff. Roger said earlier that he's up to, was it quarts or pounds, Roger, of tomatoes? Oh, my God, Irish Dave. Robin, it's not like they're called him a canes. Pronouns, damn it. Pronouns. Good point. Irish Dave said, so Scott Perry's calls to 1-800-SEX-IT-UP aren't covered by that? No, those are 1-900 numbers. Oh, come on. It's 1-900-SPANK-ME. That's where the Scott Perrys of the world go, Dave. Get with the program. So, thanks to our all-volunteer staff, again, thank you, Roger, thank you, to our news ninjas, thank you, Brother Deacon Asa, head on.live. Like, subscribe, please, leave a comment. It helps. We're trying to grow this conversation, especially leading into an election year. Thanks, John Fox in Australia. Thank you, Ben Birch, WhiteRoseSociety.org. Thanks to the hardest-working, bravest people I know, the folks at Coal River Mountain Watch. More than 20 years at the forefront of the struggle for human rights and environmental justice in Appalachia, and a proud union shop. Time to make the plan to get the booster! And for God's sakes, wear your masks. Just generally, if there's, what Paul from Parts Unknown say, if there's more, if you're around more than five people who aren't from your household, and God knows if you know you're around the maggots, wash your hands, don't touch your face, use your hand sanitizer, carry some with you, pocket or purse, maintain your social distance as best you possibly can. Oh no, there's a scary thought, Brother Deacon. I know this is all hypothetical bullshit, but if Bishop Willard was running against Rotted FK today, I'd happily vote Bishop Willard. That might be the first Republican vote I had ever cast in my entire life. Lucky for us both, you and Canoodlia, and me not having to deal with it, it ain't gonna happen. I don't know what the hell I'd do if Rotted FK was the nominee. It's a hell of a thing. Probably have nightmares about it tonight. And Cynthia, thank you so much for those kind words earlier. You made my evening. Frau Dr. Robin. It's nice. I hope I don't have to go to Heidelberg and get a scar on my face. It's more work for the facial feminization surgery people to do. Who am I kidding? And of course, if an orange, gigantic, demented circus peanut comes toward you ranting about the Panama Canal, avoid him like the plague. Because he is. And always, 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 Gina, it's all for you. Love you, Wayne. Lighter.